It is estimated that each human body is host to about 3 to 5 pounds of bacteria. That is a lot of bacteria. And when we think of microscopic organisms, we often think harmful to our health, right? But over the last several years, there's been a thrust in scientific research concerning all of this bacteria that live on and inside our bodies. The early findings have been astounding and seem to point to a paradigm shift in medicine. The research has the potential to unveil new methods to treat all sorts of common diseases, including diabetes, asthma, even obesity. And here to help explain the enormous potential behind the research into what's called the human microbiome is MSU microbiologist Rob Britton. Nice to see you, Rob. How are you?
Oh, good. Thanks for having me.
Just briefly, what is the human microbiome? This is the bacteria that live on and inside our bodies?
Yes, and so the human microbiome really refers to the collection of genes that are within the communities that live within and upon our body. The term microbiota refers to the microbial communities themselves. And as you mentioned in the introduction to your segment, we think that most people will think that's gross. But in essence, that's because we always think that bacteria are bad and they actually cause disease. But essentially, 99.9% of the time when we're feeling good and we're healthy, and that the bacteria are actually there all the time, and they're promoting this health. And so that's really what the NIH Microbiome Project is trying to do, is to try to figure out how we're going to be able to promote health using microbiology, and what happens to those communities when we actually get sick. So why do we actually get sick when these communities get out of whack?
Was there a sort of an aha moment that helped push this research into the forefront, or have we known that there's beneficial bacteria for a long time?
Well, we've actually known that there's been beneficial bacteria for a long time. It's really been a rediscovery of this notion. So back in the early 1900s, the Nobel Prize-winning immunologist Ilya Metchnikoff actually decided, after he won the Nobel Prize, to spend the next part of his career trying to figure out why Bulgarian peasants live longer than everybody else in Eastern Europe. And what he found out was that it was because they drank kefir, or this fermented milk. And he even went so far as to suggest it was because of the lactic acid bacteria that was in that milk that was causing them to be healthy. And so interestingly, the reason that we've really rediscovered all this is really due to technology. And so one is that because we have 100 trillion microbes in our gut, how do you study something that diverse? I mean, it's really difficult to study all of these organisms at once. And so next-generation sequencing technologies, which allow us now to study 50 billion base pairs of DNA in a single experiment, are now allowing us to explore the microbiome, or essentially the 5 million genes that are now present in our body as part of the microbial genomes. And that's 1,000 times more than the genes that we have in our human genome. We only have 25,000 genes in our own genome. So they really provide a lot of physiological and important functions for our body.
One really fascinating feature of this whole story involves childbirth. And I've read that birth through the vaginal canal, as opposed to a cesarean section, is where crucial bacteria are actually picked up. Can you tell us more about the role of childbirth in the development of our microbiome?
Well, certainly. So before you're born, you're thought to be sterile. And so you become colonized initially through a passage through the vaginal tract. And so if you're born through cesarean section, you actually miss that opportunity to be colonized with certain bacteria. And, of course, you're usually being fed formula or milk, and so that's another issue. There's thought to be milk oligosaccharides that are important for developing our microbiome. So if you're being fed formula, that can raise some problems. And then there's thought to be an ecological succession. So as babies continue to be fed formula and then move into solid foods, essentially your microbiome then changes over time until we get to essentially what's an adult state. But what I can tell you is that adults, you and I, would, if we looked at our microbiome right now, they would look pretty much completely different. We wouldn't really know exactly that we have the same sort of functional microbiome. And that's one of the really interesting things that's come out of all these studies, is that it's not necessarily that we all share the same species that we could identify with a name, but it's usually probably the functions that they provide. And so that's why it's been very difficult to move from understanding how these communities get shifted to basically how they function when they're giving us good health, and what happens to them when they undergo a dysbiosis, or which is really referring to when these communities get out of whack. How do they cause problems such as allergies and diarrhea and obesity? And that's really what a lot of studies in my lab and really all over the world are going after now.
What's the timeline on this? Do you have any kind of feeling for when we might really strike gold with this, I suppose, just in terms of a treatment or a cure for a disease? Is that on anybody's radar?
Well, you know, interestingly, there already is a cure for disease using microbes, and that is actually a project that we also study in my lab, and that's studying Clostridium difficile, which is...
C. diff.
Yeah, C. diff, right? It's a pathogen that actually is the most common cause of antibiotic-associated diarrhea, and it's really a problem now because... it is also the most common cause of hospital-acquired infections. So you go to the hospital, you're sick, you don't want to be there anyway, and then on top of it, you get this nasty diarrhea. And unfortunately, for a number of patients, anywhere from 15 to 40%, depending on the outbreak, they will actually have recurring C. diff, which means they go through a terrible cycle of they go to the hospital, they get diarrhea, they get nasty antibiotics to get rid of C. diff, and then 2 weeks later after the antibiotics are stopped, they get it again. And you can have 25, 30, 35 bouts of this in a year. Essentially, you can't do anything. And so what the best therapy for that is, in fact, a fecal transplant.
A fecal transplant.
Yeah, so now we can say that's gross. Bacteria are gross, but that's gross. And essentially, what is done is that these people, what has probably happened to them is their microbial communities are just so disrupted that they can't recover after the antibiotic treatment. So we basically transplant another community from usually a family member, and that's 92% effective in breaking a recurrent C. diff. Now, the problem with that is that, of course, you're transferring a lot of other things in stool, things like worms and viruses and fungi. And so we really want to try to build a community synthetically that we can isolate from the human microbiota and basically put that in rather than putting in stool.
Wow. There's been a glut of health products. I don't think anybody's visited the health food store lately that hasn't seen a product that touts probiotic cultures. Yogurt is associated with this to quite an extent. And in other foods, do these help?
Well, I think in general, yes, they do help. But what I can say about the sort of the probiotic industry is essentially that many of these organisms that you can go out and buy right now on the market are ones that have not been scientifically or clinically validated. And so if you're a consumer and you go out to look at, say, Foods for Living, the health food store locally here, you could have 100 or so, products that are thrust at you, many from very small companies. And so what I can say is that they probably will not hurt you, but there's probably not a lot of evidence for the small company ones that will actually help you. Because they're dietary supplements, they really have not passed the muster in terms of having clinical studies that you would need to do to have a drug. And that's why when you go out, the products will not say that we will cure diarrhea, we'll cure obesity, we'll cure this, because if they say that, the FDA is going to regulate them like a drug. And so it's a bit of a conundrum. And the NIH is well aware that the bacteria are going to have a role in our health in the future. And there's going to be therapeutic microbiology. And it will, in my opinion, in the next 10 to 15 years, we'll start seeing real products that are going to be targeted for these diseases. But it's going to take time because the FDA is going to say, if we're going to target microbiology or bacteria to help a disease, you're going to have to prove it to us the same way that a drug will be done.
How many students do you work with who are involved in this kind of research here at MSU?
Well, right now I've got about 15 people in my lab, and so we work in a number of different areas, one of which being C. diff, trying to basically build a synthetic community to help people with recurrent C. diff get out of that relapse without having to use stool.
Is that you spend a lot of your time on that particular?
That's one of our main projects in the lab right now.
Okay.
And we also are working on a really interesting project where we have found a probiotic bacterium that can actually improve bone health, both in a type 1 diabetes model and also in a mouse model of menopause. And so we're really excited about that. We're getting very close to submitting that for publication, and we're hoping to have a human trial start here in the next 6 to 12 months.
How did you end up in this study? Did you know a long time ago that you wanted to be involved in microbiology, or?
Well, to be honest, when I arrived here, I was very much a basic researcher, studying stuff most of your listeners would probably never have even heard of. But when I got here, I realized that I did want to do something applied, and it was pretty clear with funding the way it is these days that NIH has said, look, we want translational research, and for good reason. People are spending their tax dollars; they want to see some payoff from what they're doing, and so That's how we got into probiotics. Fortunately, we did early on when it wasn't so sexy to be working on probiotics or the microbiome. So we've had a pretty good run here in the last few years, and we have some good traction in this area. We hope to be making some big discoveries in the next 5 to 10 years.
Have you learned anything else about health in general that might be of value to just the ordinary person listening? Do you have any other insights that you might be in a position to share with us?
Well, what I would say is that based on your intro to the show, when you said the bacteria are gross, I just want people to know that, you know, the fact of the matter is that bacteria are actually quite good for you. And in fact, we wouldn't be here. People are thinking of bacteria as the forgotten organ now, because it basically, if we didn't have them, our immune systems wouldn't develop. We couldn't eat food the way we do. And we wouldn't be here, quite frankly. So we really, so your listeners, please, bacteria, good. Be nice to them. They're nice to you, and they're important for you. Thanks.
Rob Britton is an associate professor of microbiology here at Michigan State University. Thanks for joining us today to talk about the fascinating research into the human microbiome.
Thanks, Martin.